Greetings and welcome to Virtually Speaking Science on Wednesday, February 11th, 2015. I'm your host, Jennifer Ouellette. Thanks for joining us. And thanks to the Exploratorium for hosting us here in wonderful Second Life and to Blog Talk Radio for airing this simultaneously and also archiving as a podcast. And as always, extra special thanks to our producer, Sherry Reason, who makes our guests look fabulous in their avatars week after week after week. Today, I'm very excited to have Lori Paul, a philosophy professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and a 2014 Guggenheim Fellow. She's also the author of a new book called Transformative Experiences, which we're going to be talking about later in the program. Welcome, Lori.
Thanks for having me on the show. I'm excited to be here.
Yeah. I actually met you a couple years ago when I was working on my book on the science of self. And in particular, I remember you being very helpful to me because at the time I was very in the early stages of researching the book and I was very frustrated at just, first of all, being able to define what is the self and also a frustration with how do we know who we are at any given moment, because it seemed to me that the self was very fluid, that we change over time. And that seems to me to be part of what it is that you do.
Yeah, I'm fascinated with how we understand ourselves, especially from the first person. So there's a way of thinking about selves when I'm looking at somebody else or imagining someone else living their life. But then there's how I regard who I am and how I live my life from the inside. And I'm really fascinated about both how those things fit together and especially with how we think about it from the inside.
Right. Well, that's, I mean, the internal-external question is very interesting because one of the things that I looked at, we have this notion of who we think we are, and we don't always realize that we're not necessarily projecting our internal life to people, that people can actually get a very different impression of who we are based on our outward behavior because they don't have access to our interior.
Right.
And it can lead to misunderstanding.
Well, and the thing is, part of what I'm worried about is we also might think we have more access to our interior than we actually do. And when we think about who we're going to become or who we're going to make ourselves into or even who we've been, I don't think we have as much access as at least we might have thought. It can be kind of apparent when you think about, you know, think about yourself 5 or 10 years ago and the way you thought about things and what you thought you were doing when you were making certain kinds of choices. A lot of times, you know, you might think, well, if I didn't know what I was doing there, or well, I was fooled there, or oh, I really knew, I really got it right that time. And I suspect that, in fact, we're in that situation over and over and over again when we regard our future selves.
Right. Well, I mean, past selves, I, you're right. I look back at my past self, particularly, you know, 15, 20 years ago. The further you go back, the more unrecognizable I think that I become to myself. But how much of that is filtered through memory, through faulty memory at that? I mean, how much do we retroactively decide what happened in the past?
Yeah, I think a lot of it is filtered through memory. I also think there's this interesting thing that can happen, whereas there's when I explicitly think back and have a memory and try to remember what I was doing and how I was thinking, and then there's the kind of memory that you have, you know, that Proust described, right? When you bite in to a cookie and suddenly you have an experience that's very much like an experience you had in the past. And then you're sort of brought back to who you were, I think, at least in some partial sense. And so sometimes we think of ourselves in this kind of detached way, like we try to remember how we were, what we were doing, how we were thinking. And then sometimes we can have these much more direct experiences of our past perspective. So I think it's a mix of both, basically.
I think actors call that an emotional memory, you know, where they try and find ways to trigger certain emotions or things based on their past experiences. It's interesting. I mean, it's similar to what Proust was talking about. They would have this really, you know, deep experience, you know, of a way to kind of go back to a past self. And he wrote a whole several volumes about that.
Right. And so there's how we look back at our past selves, and then for me, there are lots of interesting questions, but two of the questions I'm really fascinated by are, first, how should we think about how we form our future selves, in particular, like in context of sort of major life choices, and then also, should we think of our lives as having some kind of narrative structure, some kind of plan that we're trying to execute? Do we, how much control do we have over that? Or is it actually, once you kind of step back and look at how things are really going, is it really a lot less organized than that? Even if you tried, maybe you can't actually plan your life the way that at least we sort of in contemporary sort of, you know, reasonably wealthy Western societies think that we can.
Right. The storytelling self. I think of it as more kind of an organic thing. The story unfolds very, very naturally and not necessarily in a very structured way. And it's something I think we tend to impose structure after the fact.
Right. I think that's right.
We reinterpret what happened and make it seem like we had motive and all this sorts of things. But your first question is actually the topic of your new book, and I think that's probably going to be the bulk of what we talk about, because it's this notion of transformative experiences. And I think the example, I don't think anybody really knows what that is, so I'll ask you to define it, but the example that I saw in a Guardian commentary on it was, what's it like to taste Vegemite for the first time? Vegemite is actually, shall we say, an acquired taste. it's not that you can say it tastes like X or it tastes like Y. You kind of have to experience it before you know what it is, and in that sense you use it as an example of this, a simple example of a transformative experience. So why don't you kind of give our audience a basic introduction of what constitutes a transformative experience as opposed to just your average, ordinary kind of experience.
Okay. Okay. So there are two dimensions, I think, that are crucial to the sort of transformative experience idea. And the first one is basically about what you know. And that's where having a really new kind of experience, like tasting Vegemite for the first time, or in my book I talk about having a durian fruit, because I've actually never tried a durian. But, you know, yeah, they're very, it's a very distinctive taste. And
like
some, yes, and some people describe it as, there are all kind of interesting ways of, yeah, it's supposed to smell like foul, rotting flesh or sewage or something like that. But if it's ripe, and it can taste delicious. So it's something, you know, so the descriptions you'll get are, well, it's like kissing a dead person or having strawberry ice cream next to the sewer. Or none of that. That's very evocative. But the thought is that until you've actually tasted something like a durian, you don't know what it tastes like. Maybe if you had something that tasted similar, you might be able to kind of extrapolate. But the thought is that when you have a really new kind of experience, or let's say you gained a new kind of sense, so that you could, say, neuroscientists implanted your, you know, a chip into your brain and you could gain a different kind of sensory capacity. Until you experience that capacity or you try the new kind of fruit, you don't know what it's like. And you might know something about it, but there's no substitute for what experience teaches. And so the thought is that there's a transformative experience first transforms what you know. So a philosopher would say it's epistemically transformative. And the thought is that some things you can only learn by having the experience. And then the other dimension that's really important for my cases involves the notion of a personal transformation. So there can be lots of experiences that are sort of distinctively new, tasting a new fruit, having a new kind of food, but they don't change you in any kind of fundamental way. They're just kind of cool, interesting experiences. But some of these new experiences might simultaneously teach you something that you couldn't know before you had the experience, but also change who you are and what you care about in the process. And those kinds of experiences are the ones I'm really fascinated by, and I think they raise interesting and special problems for how we deliberate and make big life choices about who we want to be and what we want to do.
Well, you know, it's interesting because we do make them. I mean, I remember having to pick a major in college.
Right.
And that's a simple question, but the fact is I changed substantially just in the 4 years of college. I think when I was, you know, 14, everybody wants to be like an actress, and then I wanted to be like major in music, and within a year I realized that music really wasn't for me, and I switched to English. When I left college, I thought, oh, I'll go to grad school in English because I had some idea of being a professor, and here I am today, a science writer. I kept making these choices without really having a clear idea of who I was going to be in the future, and I clearly did a very bad job at projecting myself into the future. What could we do better on that score?
Well, I think it's a difficult question. So there are options. I mean, often people want to talk to other people. You talk to friends and family. What have they done? You could talk to other people who are in the major and get their impressions. The problem is that you can't make that kind of decision based solely on what they think, because what matters is how their experiences connect to who you are and how you would respond. So just because many people enjoyed being English majors, there were other people that, of course, didn't enjoy becoming English majors or didn't take it through to graduate school. And you have, when you're making that kind of choice, you have to try to figure out, well, am I more similar to the people who are choosing to major in English, or am I more similar to the people that actually didn't work out for? And sometimes you might have some sense of who you're more similar to, but I think a lot of times it's a bit of, it's a guess. It's much more of a guess even than we want to admit to ourselves.
Well, we're such multifaceted human beings. I mean, you can't define a person, anyone, you know. You can try and compare yourself to other people who are English majors, but there's a lot more to those people than just being English majors, and you don't know whether the English major thing is what makes you similar or not.
Exactly. Sorry, I didn't mean to. Exactly right. So individuals are heterogeneous. They're very, you know, every individual has a whole bunch of different properties and a bunch of different characteristics. And the problem is that unless I know which characteristics matter to making somebody, and which combination of characteristics matter to making someone satisfied with being, say, an English major, and then whether or not I'm similar to that person in the same way, then I can't actually make a super informed decision. I can make a guess. I can try to play the numbers, but it's not a very reliable way, I think, to make the choice. Often people think, well, you just have to kind of look within yourself and you have to think carefully about what you really want and who you really are. But that's exactly the kind of process that I'm worried, even though we use it, doesn't actually give us the information that we're looking for.
Right. And certainly at 18, I didn't know who I really was. I knew who I thought I was at the time, and it turns out I was someone really different. Also,
And you
and
might
this
have.
actually gets, this gets to the crux, I think, of the transformative experience. We make a choice, we have the experience, that experience changes us, and we become the person who would have made that choice. It's a chicken and egg
Exactly.
problem.
Exactly. So, you know, you say, well, you know, maybe I wasn't the, you know, maybe it took me a while to make the decision, and then I made the decision, and then it wasn't the right decision for me. Well, let's say you had made the choice and you decided it was the right decision for you. It might be that the fact of, that's right, taking the English classes and connecting with the professors changed who you were, so that the person that you become, an English major, is happier with her choice simply because she became an English major. And
Right.
sometimes that works, but sometimes it doesn't. And if you're looking within yourself and thinking, well, you know, am I a person who wants to study Shakespeare or Jane Austen or you know, whatever else you might want to focus on, some kind of poetry, and maybe you think, well, I'm not that kind of person, but other people seem very happy with the choice. So maybe if I choose to become an English major, that'll make me into the kind of person who loves to study Shakespeare. And lo and behold, it works for some people.
Yeah. And for others, not
And not, yeah, others not so much.
So, you know, it's an interesting question. And of course, one of the biggest examples that you gave turned out to be a kind of controversial one. It's a topic that comes up again and again. You use the example of whether to have or not have children. And in particular, you wrote a paper about this. And the irony being that you wrote it with your husband, who's a sociologist, Kieran Healy, and you have two children together. And you're basically saying that it's impossible to make a truly rational decision on this kind of topic. And that rubbed a lot of people the wrong way. And now, this is just a touchy issue in general, okay? Because, you know, Sean and I, my husband Sean and I, are childless by choice. And I consider myself very fortunate to have found a man eventually who, you know, was like me and did not actually want to have children. I also think that I can't say that I would have been miserable if things had been different and I had had children. I don't think I can make that choice. I don't think I can make a value judgment. All I can say is it unfolded nicely in my life, and I'm happy that way. So much when I see commentary on this, I see people taking sides. So I like the fact that you're a mother and yet you're able to kind of objectively look at the problem and not pass judgment based on, you know, you're not one of those mothers who say, well, you'll never be fulfilled until you're a parent, which is actually something
right.
that was said past week. You know, in an article.
That's, well, exactly. So I think I'm fascinated by this particular decision. There are other, I think, major life-changing decisions that fall into this category, but the choice of whether or not to have your first child is especially good because it happens at a time when we're not, for many of us anyway, we're no longer adolescents, so we've got our fully formed intellectual capacities. We see that we can this distinctive and important choice is going to have a big effect on the rest of our lives. So it's a good example of just the kind of transformative choice that I think can teach us a lot about the way that we should think about molding our future selves. But it also connects, I think, with a lot of other issues. So maybe I'll just say what I think, which is I think that once we realize that having a baby is a very distinctive new kind of experience, and in particular forming the attachment to the newborn that you produce. That's actually the main way in which I think people have a very new experience. I think that realizing that until you have that experience, you can't make a decision based on how you think you would react to having that experience is a first important step. And then also realizing that, look, maybe the process of undergoing that experience changes you as a person, so that this is a bit like, you know, the English major case, right? It changes who you are, so that, of course, you know, many people, not everyone, but many people are happy with it afterwards. But just because you underwent an intense new kind of experience with lots of pluses and minuses, such that it formed you into someone who was glad that they had gone through that experience, doesn't mean that a person who hasn't gone through that experience is irrational or not rational for not wanting to do it.
Mm-hmm.
So the thought is that, look, you know, there's a kind of simplistic picture. Well, I'm happy with this now, so obviously it was the right thing for me to do, and that I want to resist, partly because I think, well, just because you're happy with it now doesn't mean that your previous self would be happy with what you've become. I mean, in fact, that's my situation. I think before I had my children, I would have been repulsed by the person who goes to bed early now and doesn't go out nearly as much as she. And I mean, I'm so boring now. You know, I was so much more interesting before. And so,
I beg to differ, but that's all right.
Thank you. So there's one kind of inference I think is completely wrong, which is that just because I'm happy now with my choice doesn't mean that when I was choosing way back when, if I knew what I, you know, was going to become, that person would have been happy with that choice. And second, just because I'm happy with that choice and because I can make myself happy with that choice by changing myself doesn't mean that other people are somehow wrong to not want to make that choice. And so this also connects then with questions about being tolerant of people's decisions to either discover what it is to become a parent. So they're just making a discovery about a new kind of, making themselves into a new kind of person, and they want to discover that. And other people, they know the life that they have, and that's the life that they want. And so there's nothing irrational about saying, oh, I know this is called status quo bias, and it's perfectly reasonable. If you're happy with who you are, then you shouldn't have to prioritize becoming a new kind of person that you're not familiar with. Does that make sense?
Yes. No, it makes perfect sense. You know, and you know, like I said, I mean, there's also, you know, the childless contingent also likes to point to several studies that show that, you know, parents mm-hmm. seem to be, you know, unhappy.
Right. So this does connect then with, yeah, there are all kinds of issues about the social science of parenthood. And most of it shows that on a lot of standard measures, people's happiness and well-being go down. I mean, it depends on how you define well-being, but there's no question that becoming a parent means that you have increased levels of stress, increased levels of anxiety, lower levels of sleep, lower levels of feeling kind of like you've got it all together and everything's under control. I could go on. There are all these very standard ways of measuring well-being that parents score lower on. They only actually go back up to the level of the childless once the children have left home. <It's not> like, so,
oh, thank God
so,
they're gone.
Yeah, it's something like, oh, now that they're gone, I can get enough sleep and eat when I want. And so now the question is, as parents will often say, well, yeah, but there's something else in my life, some kind of meaningfulness that that I'm gaining, even if all of these other things are really difficult and terrible. And part of what I'm interested in is trying to be, people need to be more precise about that. I think, well, what is this kind of meaningfulness? And I don't think they're wrong. I think there is, but it can just, maybe it's just meaningful to make discoveries about different ways you could live, and becoming a parent is one interesting, meaningful way of discovering something about the world.
I actually do have, you know, just a random thought on this, because I think a lot about, you know, because I also wrote a book on, the self book came out of my book, The Calculus Diaries, where I, you know, had this notion that I, you know, was bad at math, and then I realized that had become a huge part of my identity, and it had no basis in fact, and it was a shock to me, and it spurred me to look into how we form who we think we are, ideas about who we think we are. And among other things, I think that we have a very unhealthy attitude towards things that are just hard. We think that if something is hard or difficult, we must be bad at it, at least if it's something in school like math or science. But say when I was doing jiu-jitsu and I was doing martial arts, you know, it was very, very hard, and I learned to just keep, you just pick yourself up and you keep doing it and, you know, do it over and over again until you get it right. Parenting is one of those hard things where the fact that it's hard and not necessarily fun, you know, all the time is what makes it worthwhile, in the same way that getting my black belt was worthwhile, or so let's say getting a PhD would be for Sean or yourself, or having children. You know, we have this notion that happiness means being happy all the time, and maybe part of what constitutes happiness is having successfully done a difficult thing and been rewarded for it.
Right. I do think that part of that is definitely the case. It's, you know, running a marathon, or one can have a sense of achievement even because you've performed something or done something that was difficult, but you learned something new in the process, and you can value, I think, that even if it doesn't make you happier in some kind of, you know, simplistic or hedonistic sense. And I would like to see some, I think there is, you know, some of the research basically reflects those that kind of complex assessment, but some of the work doesn't, or maybe it was older work, didn't do such a great job of reflecting that issue. But let me just emphasize, and there's this other thing, though, which you alluded to earlier, which is, I think, really important. Sometimes it's, well, maybe you're happier because you're happy in the sense that you're satisfied with the difficult, achieving something difficult. But I also just think there's something psychological that happens to people, and that they really do change what their preferences are as a result of the experience. And so, you know, we have this really interesting kind of bias about ourselves, okay? And the bias is like, well, look, maybe I was wrong before, but now I really know what I want and what I'm doing, okay? So, you know, and the way I think of it is like we throw our past selves under the bus all the time. And I think that's what parents do a lot of times. Well, I would never change. I would never wish away my child. So obviously I did the right thing and I'm so happy. And that's right. I would never wish away my children. I love them. But that's not evidence that, again, that the person who I was made the right decision. I just, who I am now is happy with or satisfied with, you know, performing these difficult tasks as part of how I live my life now. So
sorry.
No, I know. When I see these debates about, you know, whether or not to become a parent, oh, you know, it's, yeah, you'll never feel fulfilled, or there's something, you know, something that you, when you're making your decision, or you're missing out on if you don't do this. Well, I just think that's a very simplistic way to think about the issue. And I also just don't think it's true in the strict and technical sense. Who you are right then when you're making the decision has no need of replacing themselves with a new person. If you do it and you're satisfied with that, that's great. But it's wrong to say that there's some kind of, I guess, rational claim on people to make that kind of change. And that's what I was arguing in the paper.
Right. Well, it's interesting to me because, you know, it doesn't happen all the time, but this is one of those issues where people take the criticism of to have or not have children as a criticism of them personally, of their life choices,
mm-hmm.
you know, because it hits
mm-hmm.
them where they live, so to speak.
Right.
And I want to move into a study that was just announced in the last week because it has some very important implications for communication and outreach, particularly on hot-button topics that really tie into personal identity, particularly identity politics and things like that, climate change, anti-vaxxers. This particular
mm-hmm.
study was done, how do you get an anti-vaxxer person, someone who is opposed to the notion of vaccines, to change their mind? And this person tried, the group did three different approaches plus a control group. I think one was just presenting them with the facts, one was telling a story, one was a different strategy that kind of had elements of both. And then one, they didn't try and change them at all. And nothing worked. In fact, they quoted, the article that I read in The New Yorker actually quoted the guy saying, we were pretty depressed. It's basically saying we can't change people's minds. But, of course, people change their minds all the time. And I guess my
mm-hmm.
question for you is, in order to change someone's mind on something that they identify with so strongly, do we first need to change who they think they are?
Well, it sounds, I mean, I think that's a really good idea. I mean, in the sense that I agree that when people have beliefs that they identify with, that they take as somehow connected with, it's hard to think about exactly how it works, but I think sometimes people think, who I am and how I understand the world is reflected in some of the beliefs that I have. And one of the reasons why I find that study incredibly interesting is when I talk with psychologists, a kind of response that they give me is, well, look, you know, we know that introspecting about who you are and what you want is often misguided. So really what you need to do is find out about the data and then adjust your beliefs so that it fits the data. And they don't mean just like, you know, rely on introspection and then kind of, you know, combine who you think you are with some of the data to try to come up with some kind of result. They mean, no, don't rely on who you think you are. Just look at the data. So now, like, an anti-vaxxer is going to be, for example, they're completely resistant to that way of thinking about things. But I'm not so sure that they're so different from other people. It just depends on the belief that you pick. So in answer to your question, one way to get people to change, it's not going to be successful to just give them some data and say, well, you should change who you are because I know about this data, and this data tells me that if you do this, you'll change who you are, and then you'll be happier or you'll make the decision. That's not going to work.
Right.
So I have no idea how to make people more flexible about giving up beliefs that are tightly held, but I don't think a kind of simple response, give them more information, tell them about the empirical work, is going to work.
It doesn't work over and over again. It just doesn't work. Which,
mm-hmm. Right.
It's bad news for those of us who care about some of these issues.
Right, right. Well, and there's also this interesting, I guess, you know, it's an interesting problem because we want to be able to respond to, you know, evidence, and we want to be able to respond to well-done studies and accurate data. I mean, that's important. And the question is, if our own beliefs about ourselves get in the way, then there's a kind of alienation that we have to experience if we're going to actually, you know, by what the scientific data is telling us in some cases. And I think that's just a really interesting issue. And maybe that's ultimately, in fact, I think rationally, that's the right thing to do, but it might be psychologically incredibly difficult for us to achieve.
Right. I'm going to take a moment here. We're at the 30-minute mark to remind people that you're listening to Virtually Speaking Science. We air every Wednesday, and at some point, you know, in addition to tuning in to me, I hope you would also tune in on subsequent Wednesdays for my fellow hosts, Alan Boyle, Kelly Hillis, and Tom Levinson. I'm here with Lori Paul, a philosophy professor at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, and we are talking about transformative experiences and what it takes to change a mind. Lori, while we were chatting right before the show, I mentioned my own thoughts on changing minds, because I'm a very, very different person than I was back when I was like 14 or 15. Someone who met me at like 15 would not even recognize me today. So obviously we change, and we change our minds, and we change our views, and sometimes radically so. But I think that there's, again, another measurement issue with some of these studies. Because it takes a long time. I tend to think of these sorts of things as being like phase transitions, because I write about physics, and a particularly slow, you know, years-long phase transition. We think of transformative experiences being these Saul on the road to Tarsus moments where you get hit by a thunderbolt and you change your mind. I think that is analogous to what's in physics is called the critical point, which is where a system gets to the point where it's just teetering between one phase or another, one state or another, and then it tips over at that point, and suddenly you're in the new state, and you've become something different. But if you chart it, if you graph those changes, say the temperature as water is heating up or freezing, what you see is no perceptible change every time you measure. You just see a straight line for like forever, and it looks like nothing's happening and nothing's changing, and all of a sudden you hit that critical threshold, that critical point, and there's a boom, sudden change, a sudden shift into the phase. And the problem is temperature is the wrong thing to measure. The temperature is not showing exactly all the tiny little minute changes going on at the atomic level in that material. And I use that as a metaphor for what is going on in people's opinions and their sense of self and identity. When you see these sudden shifts and these sudden changes in opinion, I think that's what we're looking at. And I'm curious whether that jibes with how you think about it.
Yeah, I have. I think that sometimes, right, you reach a kind of critical point and there's a sudden transition. But sometimes these transformative experiences and transformative changes occur over an extended period of time. And as a philosopher, I'm really interested in thinking about this there are a bunch of different ways to think about this kind of situation. So I like to think about time slices. And so there's who I am, let's say, in 2000, and there's my time slice, let's say, on January 1st in 2000. And then, you know, there's the time slice of me now here talking with you. And I have to say that I never would have predicted in 2000 that I would be having this kind of conversation with you, that I would have even written any of this material. But obviously, if you went sort of time slice by time slice, you know, day by day, moment by moment, the evolution would be very slow. And if I measured the right thing, maybe I would see it coming. But it's not clear that from our first personal perspective, we are noticing the right thing so that we're able to kind of measure the right thing. So it seems like from the first personal perspective, that there's a sudden change or a kind of dramatic shift.
Right.
And maybe we're not able to measure those more gradual changes from our first personal point of view, because again, you know, there's the impersonal scientific perspective that you can take of somebody as they're evolving over time. But then there's what you know about yourself and how you map your own future. And obviously, you're, at least in theory, the person who's in control. And so if you can't detect those changes, then you can't factor them in when you're thinking about your future selves and when you're thinking about your choices.
Right. There's a lot of variables that go into shaping who we are and how we think about our future selves, and we're not always aware of the things as they're impacting us.
Right. Right. And it can seem, you know, certain kinds of properties can seem much more relevant than they should, or maybe very relevant ones that aren't accessible to us for various reasons. And then also I just think that it's because we depend on memory, for example, or imagination to try to think about our past or think about our futures. Certain psychological facts about ourselves determine what we're able to do. So if I can't remember something about myself, or let's say for psychological reasons I won't allow myself to remember something about myself, or if I can't imagine myself in various kinds of situations, then I'm constrained. Even if various properties I have will determine how I'm going to respond to future situations, I still can't know that from the first person.
Right, right. You know, I think that you and Kieran actually quote Stephen Wright, one of my favorite comedians. You know, experience is something you don't get until just after you need it. The implication being, of course, that there's no such thing as making a rational decision, and that what we're all really doing is taking leaps of faith that and then somehow we interpret it as being a rational choice. You know?
I definitely
jump. You know, pick one, and you'll probably maybe it'll work out, maybe it won't.
Well, I definitely think there's some cognitive dissonance. I think there's a lot of confirmation bias. Like, there are all kinds of things that we do. And I do think that lots of choices can be made rationally, where I'm just adopting a kind of standard view where we're maximizing expected utility, and there are different ways to think about that. But just in the simplest way, a lot of our decisions, I think we can think about in terms of uncertainty, that, you know, if I've been to a restaurant before and I know the different kinds of dishes on offer, maybe I don't know exactly what the burger is going to be like tonight, or the steak is going to be like, or the vegetarian entree, but I know enough to, you know, assign a credence or a probability to the outcome, and to be able to have a sense of what the utility is. And so I can make my, you know, I can make a choice based on that assessment. But when we're faced with dramatically new experiences, we just don't have that kind of information. And so that's right. So then it's not clear that we have a model for a rational choice in that situation. So maybe we are just kind of stumbling from major choice to major choice. And then we kind of reflect back, and sometimes we can construct a model that seems kind of rational, but I think it's often, I guess, Monday morning quarterbacking would be the way to describe it.
You know, it's interesting because you also work on empathy, and it seems to me that this does have some implications for empathy, because, you know, theory of mind is something that psychologists talk a lot, cognitive psychologists toss around a lot. You know, are you able to project yourself into the experience? You know, you're able to walk a mile in someone else's moccasins, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the way we do that is by trying to find the common ground. But I think that there are some implications here, because we're going to meet people with whom we cannot empathize. Not really. If we haven't had the kinds of different transformative experiences. So what are the implications for that?
Excellent. Yes. So there are two, I think, really sort of significant ways that there are implications here. So in the first one involves a notion of social choice, where it's founded on the thought that one is supposed to empathize with other people, and in order to assess their preference structure, in order to do certain kinds of maybe public policy planning or other kinds of assessments. And my arguments suggest that for principled reasons, not just a matter of like not thinking hard enough, but for principled reasons, we just might not be able to, as you put it, step into the moccasins of individuals that are just distinctively different from us. Because there's obviously this problem of other minds, where I can't see into the mind of another person. And so empathy is supposed to be a replacement for that. Well, I imagine what it would be like for me in their shoes, and that's how I see into their mind. But if it's impossible for me to step into their shoes for the reason that, you know, say, I talk about examples like this in my book. Like, imagine, you know, trying to be a slave or an escaped slave in Jamaica during the rebellion. You know, I can imagine something, but I don't think I can imagine what it was like for a person in that situation. I don't think I can imagine what it would be like on the front lines of in a war. And in fact, that's what people testify to. And so their first problem is, it's not clear that one of the fundamental or basic tools for a social choice, namely the use of empathy as a way of assessing the preferences of other people, is actually going to be usable in circumstances when we need it most. Maybe we can evaluate people who are very much like ourselves, but that's not the main reason why we want to be able to do certain kinds of policy and public planning. And then there's another thing that's related to this, which is thinking about our future selves, because another way in which we assess preferences and make decisions involves trying to put ourselves in the shoes of our future self. You know, how would I respond to this, or how will I respond to that? What would I like to be doing, you know, 10 years from now? Who do I want to be? How do I want to be? And so it's not just a problem of empathizing with other people. I also have to be able to empathize with my future self if I want to be able to decide to do things that my future self will be happy about. And the further suggestion is, look, it's not even a problem. It's not just a problem about other people. It's a problem I have for myself at any other time other than the time I'm at now. So my future time slices are in just as much trouble.
You know, I want to segue, because one of the questions that we had from an audience member had to do this past week, just the past couple of days actually. You know, Boston Dynamics builds all these robots, and they built a robot dog. And there was a video circulating on YouTube of some of the researchers kicking the dog, robot dog, and people got very, very upset. Even though technically the dog is a robot and has no quote-unquote feelings or even senses, there's an empathy thing that's happening there, even in the virtual sphere. And that segues very nicely. I mean, you can comment a little bit on the robot dog, but also, you know, this is your first time in Second Life. One of the things that I talked about a great deal in my book was avatars as representations of self. So let's talk about the robot dog and internet experiences, but also, you know, can a virtual world, can experiences in a virtual world like Second Life also be transformative?
Yeah, and so I think that virtual experiences are just as much experiences as any other kind of experience. And part of what's important about that is, if I learn about who I am and what I'm doing via having experiences, then if I, and so this is back to the, you know, say if I'm in Second Life and I kick a puppy, then not only is it a kind of, a kind of bad thing to do in terms of like social mores or whatever, I'm also doing something and having a certain kind of experience that is a bad experience. And it's not the sort of thing I should do, whether it's virtual or whether it's, you know, just because, you know, when I perform that task of kicking the puppy, I don't have insight into the experience of the puppy. I just perform that action, and it's just the same whether I perform it on a robot dog or on a real dog, at least from my point of view. And so what I'm doing has, I think, the same kind of impact in each case. And so if that's right, and I feel like that's part of why it seems, I think, terrible to watch someone kick a robot dog, then of course I can have transformative experiences virtually. I mean, some people think we're brains in vats anyway, and that every experience is basically. And I do in my book say that I'm assuming that we're not brains in vats, and that our experiences are veridical in the sense of somehow connected to the world, whether that's directly or indirectly, as it would be in virtual reality. But that's more to kind of set aside certain kinds of questions about objective value, as opposed to thinking that it's what really matters is that you have the experience and you learn from that experience, from the character of that experience, what it's like.
I mean, there certainly are things, you know, learning from experience, say, like a surgeon. I mean, there's no way for a surgeon, you know, to know what it's like to operate on someone until you actually start operating on someone. You can practice on cadavers and all you want, but it's, there's that first time. I've often thought about this. What is it like for a surgeon the first time they have to cut into someone for real?
Right.
You know, a living, breathing human being after all that practice. And I don't think there's really any way to prepare yourself for it. It's a truly transformative experience. And they are trained on cadavers. There are wonderful virtual reality programs with lots of haptic feedback to try and, you know, simulate that. I don't think we're quite there yet in terms of really simulating that kind of real-world experience.
I think that's right. I think there are two issues here. One is that the simulation is imperfect, and people are very good at detecting the imperfections. And then the related thing is that if you believe that it's real, the character of the experience is going to be different than if you believe it's virtual. And I think the more that you believe it's real, the more intense the experience will be in a certain way in terms of like forming your response or affecting your response.
Right. You know, it's interesting. There's a guy at Stanford, Jeremy Bailenson, known to several people, I think, in our audience, who does a lot of work with avatars and in virtual worlds. And among other things, he's found that the behavior and experiences of your avatar in the virtual world actually can shape your behavior in the real world. I'm always interested when I have guests on, you know, what is their avatar going to be like, you know? And I love yours because you're Lori. I mean, it's, I met you, so I know that you actually look like this. we had Simon DeDeo, who's a complexity theorist. His avatar was a swarm of butterflies, which posed a unique challenge. You know?
Yeah, that's nice.
he went all abstract and conceptual. and other people, you know, like I do a steampunk thing. And so, but clearly we're all trying to express a tiny bit about who we think we are. You know, and there's got to be a give and take, is my feeling, is that by doing that, the act of creating that avatar solidifies or shapes in some way or firms up your notion of who you think you are because you've actually had to sit down and consciously think about it and craft it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think there are two things. I mean, one is that I have to figure out which properties I want my avatar to have and so which properties sort of represent me. But I also want to use that to tell other people in Second Life as well as, you know, like who I am. And so there are two levels because they know that I was able to pick whatever I wanted, I mean, more or less. And so they can learn something about me by the choices that I make, and I can learn something about them by the choices that they make.
And there's a performative aspect to it, I guess.
I like that. I like that aspect of it. But I feel like that's a real experience, and so I learned something really about you, you know, in virtue of the experience that we're having in Second Life.
Right, right. So we're wrapping up here, but I know that beforehand we were chatting about a debate you've been having on data. You know, it's kind of tied to the measurement issues we've been talking about with Paul Bloom. And just from, you know, the little bit we talked about it, I think that our audience would really be interested in this. I mean, you're actually doing a back and forth with him, I think, that is or will be appearing in Slate. Maybe you can...
Yes. We're not quite done with it, but I think it'll appear probably in a... Probably, I'm guessing, in about 2 weeks, maybe in a week. And we're discussing my book. And he was asking me about the role of introspection and as a psychologist, he's, you know, very skeptical about how we should use or how much we should rely on introspection in the first place. So he's sympathetic to the idea that that's right, you know, before you have a transformative experience like, you know, becoming a parent or becoming demented or various other kinds of things that can happen, possibly like losing your sight, that you can't know what that's going to be like or how you're going to respond to it just by introspecting. And so we were talking about the implications of that fact combined with what I've been saying about rational choosing and rational choice, because the natural thing to do is to move to what the empirical work shows us, like to look at the data when you make the choice, which of course I agree with, but there are interesting, I think, implications with making that move.
Right. So what's next for you?
Oh gosh. So I'm fascinated by the way that we try to form ourselves through experience. So I'm interested in how we try to control our experiences to make ourselves into people that we want to be. I'm also fascinated by the way we might fear certain experiences. So you might fear trying, you know, LSD because you don't want to know what it's like, because you don't want to know, you don't know how that will structure who you'll become. And so I want to write some more about that. And I'm also really interested
Totally should.
I'm working on a piece and I plan on I'm going to write something on it and I'm going to present it probably over the next few months to a number of places. And And I'm also really interested in the nature of time and how we understand ourselves in time and the way that we understand ourselves in change. And so I'm not sure how these things come together, but I have this deep intuition that the transformative experience work is going to come together with how we view ourselves in time in a kind of much more kind of metaphysical and physical sense. And so I want to explore that.
Yeah, I have. I can see that too. I mean, I can't articulate it, but mm-hmm. you know, everything we've been talking about is about change, and change happens over time, and so that's just a very fundamental connection there. It doesn't
right.
mean that you figured
right.
it out, but I can see why you would think there was an intuitive link.
Yeah, I'm just trying to figure out. There's something going on there, and I'm grappling with that right now, and I haven't got anything that I can articulate either. But I know how I work, and I know it's back there. You know, I just have to work on it for a while, and it'll surface.
It's all part of your ongoing, you know, transformative experience.
Yeah, yeah, it is. Well, discovering these things, and that's what I like. Why I like philosophy, because I get to think about things, and I think, whoa, wait a second. So writing this book actually was pretty transformative for me, because I've been thinking about these issues for about 20 years, but I didn't know that's what I was thinking about. I mean, I just was fascinated by a whole bunch of different things, and I realized, I sort of sat down and started writing the book, and it all just sort of came together and kind of poured out of me. And so that was really kind of weird and fun, because I thought, oh, that's why I'm so fascinated with Thomas Nagel and what it's like to be a bat and the problem of other minds. And that's why I'm so interested in rational deliberation and choice. I mean, you know, it all comes together in the book.
It does. It was the act of writing the book, you're right, that made it all come together. You know,
mm-hmm.
and as a writer,
mm-hmm.
I have found that, you know, that sometimes you just got to, that's again, you got to jump. You just got to start doing it and just trust that you're going to figure it out. And that can
mm-hmm.
be a hard thing to do.
Mm-hmm. And to, like, you know, let the writing control what you're doing instead of thinking you've got it all mapped out before you sit down, you know, in
right.
front of the computer.
We had one last question from the audience. We have just enough time for it, because it gets back to our discussion on empathy. And this notion of the uncanny valley that's a common, you know, in animation,
mm-hmm.
that, you know, there's you know, we either like cartoon characters that look nothing like us or real people, but, you know, there's been, you know, certain, like the Polar Express, I think, was an animated movie where they tried to, like, have the animations be as real as possible, and it just ended up freaking people out. They didn't like it
mm-hmm.
at all.
mm-hmm.
They didn't look
right.
human, and they didn't look cartoon, and then people just did not, you know, it just destroyed any kind of, you know, it's so important when you're watching something to be able to empathize with the characters and in order to evoke emotions while you're watching this film. And for some reason, it's easier to empathize with a human actor or Donald Duck and nothing in between.
Mm-hmm. 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 Yeah, I think that's pretty fascinating. Although, you know, one interesting thing is that I think it's good that you thought of Polar Express, because I think adults are much more repulsed by that than children are.
Ah, well, you're a mom, so did your
yeah,
kids
no, I mean, I'm kind of, I find that the film kind of disturbing and kind of angst-ridden, and especially when they go up to the North Pole, and my kids just think it's just great. They're totally on board with it. And I don't understand why that is, but I suspect that they focus on different properties of it. And so there's something about the uncanny part, that's right, where it's not quite real, but almost, that I want to think of it as real, but I know it's not, and so something's wrong. I understand that something's wrong, and I don't know where to put that feeling about what's wrong, and I can't respond in the way that I naturally would if it was real or it looked perfectly real, like it was, you know, it was indistinguishable from reality, because of course I would respond naturally. So I don't have a guide or a compass about how to interact, and I feel like that's part of, for me anyway, why I feel so uncomfortable. I don't know how to read the properties that I'm detecting.
Right. Whereas I have no problem reading WALL-E. You know, I cried like
right.
a baby at WALL-E.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. There, it's just so obvious that it's not real. So I'm not, you know, I'm not engaging in this kind of tense process of thinking, oh, it's real. Oh, it's not. Oh, it's real. Oh, it's not. But there's this little thing that's not quite right. So wait a minute, where am I? What am I doing? It's just all, you know, like big eyes and cute noises and yeah. I mean, an emotion, you know, there's no
Yeah, we focus more on the emotion and on empathizing with the experiences of the character, and we don't get caught up on whether the character looks real or not.
And we're not distracted by the little bits that make it that where it's, we know if it's looking almost real, we want to respond as though it were, but then we get distracted by the little bits that aren't quite fitting in the picture. Whereas we don't have that distraction if we aren't even trying to kind of make it real.
Right. And, of course, that's one of the arguments for trying to at least get the, you know, science nominally correct or at least somewhat believable or credible, is because you don't want anything that pulls the viewer out of the experience.
Right.
You know, anything that distracts us and pulls us out of that ruins the experience for us.
That's good. You know, and that relates back to what you were saying about how do you get people to change their beliefs, right? Because one way you're not going to do it is if you try to fool them with something that's just a little bit off, then they're going to hold on. If they're in, you know, if they're finding it uncanny, they're going to hold on to their beliefs even more because they're going to feel insecure.
Right. Right. Well, I guess that's all we have time for today. Thanks to everyone for joining us. I'm so sorry that we had some technical issues at the very beginning that Lori and I were blissfully unaware of. We just had a great chat. the conversation has been taped. It will be archived. Anything that you missed, you'll be able to catch up on. I encourage you to do it because this has been a fantastic conversation. Thanks again to the Exploratorium, to Blog Talk Radio, and our marvelous producer, Sherry Reason. And thank you, Lori. It's been a fantastic discussion, and hopefully I will see you in person one of these days.
Yes, yes. Thanks very much for having me on the show.
Great, thanks. You were fabulous. This was-